The Guardian.
Hello, welcome to Guardian Football Weekly. It's Ellis James here. No Max Rushton today, unfortunately. He is busy on Nature Knows, a three-day residential course he's running in Hertfordshire. If you're lucky enough to get a place and join Max at his country pile, you'd better not pack a wash bag, as he bans shower gel, shampoo, aftershave, soap and deodorant through a combination of seminars and intimate play. Max teaches couples to fall in love with the natural aroma of their partners, thus strengthening their bond at a time of high relationship breakdown, and all for a mere £3,500 plus VAT. Max is already taking bookings for 2021. What a panel we have for you today. Gramsci, Machiavelli, Bandini, the latest in a long line of great Italian thinkers, and we're lucky to have him here at The Guardian. Paolo, how are you?
Well, I was doing well, but now I'm just gutted I'm not with Max in his retreat. It sounds amazing.
Yeah, he thinks that, to be honest, herbal essences, Radox, it's killing relationships. We need to get back. We need to get down and dirty. We need to know what our partners smell like, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, do you use shower gel?
Yes, I do, yeah.
Well, okay, It's the modern way.
In 2020, I guess I'll fix that.
Yeah, great, okay. Yeah. Who could forget Alan Shearer's hat-trick on his debut for Southampton against Arsenal as a 17-year-old? Rooney's debut for Everton. Craig Hignett's debut for Barnsley against Huddersfield in 1998. Hoping to make a similar splash on this podcast, it's debutant George Elek. George, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm feeling the pressure now after that introduction.
But the great podcasters of our age, they thrive on pressure.
Well, but now I'm a bit distracted because I'm thinking that I need to book Max's retreat before this goes out and it's all taken up.
So. Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, Max, he doesn't really want me to sell his retreat, but you know what I mean. He's counted his money at the end of the day. And finally, to my left, James Joyce, Samuel Beckett, Daniel O'Donnell, Keith from Boyzone. Whether it's low, middle or highbrow, Ireland has always culturally overachieved. And now, after a mere 13 years on this podcast, the Emerald Isle has a new favourite son. It's Barry Glendenning. How are you, Barry?
I'm very well, thank you.
Yes. What are your opinions on Daniel O'Donnell?
I don't really have any strong opinions on Daniel one way or the other.
Was he not on telly a lot when you were growing up?
He was, but I would generally just change the channel.
Oh, right. Okay.
He's quite niche. All ladies like him.
I assumed that he was like an Irish Anton Deck and that he was massively popular.
I don't think so, no. I think that the Deck to his aunt would be his sister Margot, who's also a popular country music singer.
Do they perform together?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Well, they may not even get on, I'm not sure.
Maybe we can make that happen.
I was perusing Max Rushton's Twitter feed, and Yari Littman and Dean Saunders and Grant Holt appear to be on his country retreat.
Do they? Well, yes. Dean Saunders hasn't used soap since 1995, has he, since his days at Aston Villa? He point blank refuses to. Okay, then. Leeds United 2, Derby County 4. It was 3-4 in aggregate. My opinion, you can keep your Champions League. Derby become the first ever side to reach the Championship playoff final after losing the first leg at home. Another absolutely fantastic game in... Well, football seems to be having some sort of breakdown in that. You know, everyone has forgotten how to defend. But George, what did you make of last night's...
It was the best game I think I've seen in about a week, which says a lot. But it was unbelievable. And it's sad now, I think, that the rhetoric around Leeds is going to be the perceived failure and burnout of Marcelo Bielsa, where the reality is anything but. They had no right to really be top of the league in March when they were. The squad itself, on paper, is nowhere near one of the best squads we've seen in the Championship. And that he got them to that position to come third was an achievement in itself with the squad they had at their disposal. And to be leading after 44 minutes 2-0 at Elland Road on aggregate and to lose 4-2 is just an unfair end to what's been an unbelievable season. And Marcelo Bielsa has changed the Championship for good. But for Frank Lampard, it's been a different season, where a lot of Chelsea fans always ask me, is he the man to replace Maurizio Sarri at Chelsea? And I say absolutely. I mean, from what I've seen, there's no chance. Tactically, he's developed a lot during the season, but there hasn't been a definitive style of play that we've seen. Whereas last night, he makes a substitution in the 44th minute by bringing Jack Marriott on for Dwayne Holmes. The 44th minute, didn't even wait the extra minutes till halftime. And Jack Marriott pops up with his first goal in 17 games before halftime to make it 1-1 in the match. And that is, as kind of tactical tweaks go and substitutions go, I mean, it could revolutionise the whole football club.
I read somewhere, George, that substitution was enforced, that Dwayne Holmes was injured, but he looked pretty hacked off to be taken off.
So. From what I could see, I think there was a thinking that maybe he wasn't completely fit but would get to half-time, and the fact that he made the change when he did wasn't enforced and certainly was tactical as well. It was questionable that in the first leg, Frank Lampard chose to lead the line with David Nugent. Yesterday it was Mason Bennett, a player who scored 4 goals in 65 games. So the decision to go into these games without someone like Marriott, who is a goal scorer, is questionable. But having said that, the impact he made when he came on was unbelievable.
As a hypothetical, if Derby were to win the playoff final, do you think they've got what it takes to succeed in the Premier League? Or do you think Frank Lampard has what it takes to succeed?
It's impossible to say at the moment because so many of their key players are there on loan. You look at Harry Wilson, who's from Liverpool, Mason Mount, who's from Chelsea, Tomori, who's from Chelsea as well. These guys probably won't be at the club next season, given Chelsea's transfer ban as well. You'd think that they'd need Mount and Tomori at least just for squad depth. So, and there's no question that they're the most important players that Derby have got. So for that reason, Lampard's going to have a huge job in his hands, whether or not they go up either way. I mean, if they're stuck in the Championship next season, there's a massive rebuilding to do to plug those gaps. If they do go up, they're going to have to strengthen even further or try and keep those players. With Lampard, early in the season, tactically, he looked very naive. He was trying to retain the ball in deep areas the whole time. He didn't really seemingly have much of an idea of patterns of play and how to get his best players in dangerous areas. Whereas as the season's gone on, he's changed his philosophy a bit, and the way that he talks to the media just shows a little bit more understanding about the game that he's playing, and given, you know, his unbelievable reputation and ability as a footballer, I think that's to be expected. Whether or not he's ready to go to Chelsea in the state they're in at the moment, I'm not sure, but with Derby, I think a playoff position was the minimum expectations this season, and he's managed that.
Well, after the game, the Derby players went round the pitch miming binoculars. Reference to the Spygate saga, which really, really made me laugh. But you know, they were top of the league as recently as it was March, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Leeds were top of the league. What next for Bielsa then?
He signed a 2-year contract, so at the moment it looks like he could stay. He said, or I mean, his interpreter, I should say, said after the game that he is willing to listen to offers, which is quite a bizarre thing to say about a man who's under contract.
Yeah, I saw that. It doesn't bode well, does it?
No, but at the same time, he's bringing through players, the likes of Jack Clarke and Jamie Shackleton, who are young kids who he's brought through this season to unbelievable effect. I was saying before off-air that Shackleton, aged 19, is already starting taking his coaching badges, having worked with Bielsa for a couple of months, purely because he thinks that's going to benefit his game. And that is the impact that his system and his philosophy and his coaching methods have had. And it just feels that there's some unfinished business.
So, like, I guess, I mean, I thought it was fascinating listening to Bielsa's sort of post-game comments. He basically was pretty hard on himself. He kept sort of saying, you know, it's up to a manager to have solutions, and he didn't have solutions. And he didn't sort of make any attempt to shy away from this, which, I mean, undoubtedly is true. That's a manager's role. But also in a game where such sort of odd, calamitous things happen as that first goal, and even after that, I thought some of the finishes on the goals, you're like, well, that's just a really nice goal. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of stuff that sort of just came together against him. But there is, whilst I understand completely what you're saying about you don't criticise him for the getting where he got with a squad of what he has, there is sort of a perception, or perhaps it's even more than that with Bielsa, that he, because he's such a demanding coach, does wear his players out. And it's a long season that's now got to the playoffs. I mean, is there an element of that in this or not? And is there also an element perhaps of that in him thinking about what he's doing next as well? Because he may be worn out by it. Like, he's put all this energy into it and then he's got to the end of it and it's like, oh, do I really want to start again from nothing next season?
Yeah, I think it's important, again, to remember that 44 minutes into their 48th game of the season, they were 2-0 up. And people who've watched Leeds this season more than I have, I mean, fans of theirs as well, will say that the intensity levels haven't dropped at all this season. I mean, the way they play is so intense, and it's so... They press so high up the pitch, and for their players it must be exhausting, and it's a small squad, but the performances have still been good. Their issue's just been scoring goals and finishing off their chances. Even yesterday they completely dominated the chances created. I think Derby scored with their 4 shots on target Kiko Casilla came in from Real Madrid in January with a huge reputation, and he's been poor, and yesterday he was poor again.
Yeah.
So I think burnout is the wrong word. There is quite clearly an issue with Bielsa's teams that they can't get over the line. Whether that's a physical thing or a mental thing, I'm not sure. Leeds have had this issue for a couple of years as well. Under Gary Monk, they won 2 of their last 11 games. So I'm not necessarily one to blame Bielsa. I think yesterday was one of those freak results.
What, historically, as in Bielsa's teams in the past have failed to get over the line?
Yeah. Exactly. But it's always put down to this idea that because he's so demanding and because the training's so demanding and because the way they play is too, it's a physical drop-off. Whereas this season, that hasn't looked the case from the outsider.
Yeah. It was quite funny, actually, at the end of the game, I think 30 minutes after the final whistle, there was no one on the pitch, no one in the stadium. Pontus Janssen, who hadn't played but was on the bench, was just sitting, looking very sad, leaning against one of the advertising hoardings. I wonder, is he still there? But it must be devastating to go so close. They have been a joy to watch, and I a little bit sad that they're not going to go up, because I would love to have seen how they'd got on next season.
It's a really weird thing because, you know, Leeds at certain times when they were in the top four had a reputation for being quite a nasty team. You know, this is purely anecdotal, but going to games, saw a couple of situations with their fans where nasty stuff happened. It isn't, the other sets of fans were blameless either, but, you sort of had that reputation when they were in the Premier League in the 90s. And yet, I do miss them from the top flight. I think they have, such a... a genuine passionate following in Leeds. The stadium clearly at this game looked like it was an absolute bear pit. It was raucous, and you feel like they're a team that would bring something to the top flight if they were not the other team, whoever it is who comes out of the playoffs now won't, but you do feel like Leeds would bring something.
I feel like if Leeds had got through the Aston Villa Leeds game at Wembley on Bank Holiday Monday, would have been one of the biggest games Wembley's ever seen. I mean, club games at least, because you've got two of the biggest clubs to ever fall out of the Premier League, two of the biggest fan bases as well, going up against each other with the needle that happened with the old ball being kicked out saga from a couple of weeks ago. So I think it's a shame. I mean, Derby are obviously a huge club as well with Premier League history, but it's a shame for me that we're not going to see those two titans clash in the Championship playoff final.
I can hear the Derby fans seething from here.
Well, there's so much rhetoric, and there's a lot spoken about Frank Lampard against John Terry, and there's, as I say, Derby are a massive, massive club who've had some tough times in the playoffs in recent years, and they deserve their chance here.
If they don't win the playoff final, is Lampard in any danger of losing his job?
I don't think so. I think because of his lack of experience, and because the Derby have seen... I mean, Harry Wilson and Mason Mount are at that club because of Frank Lampard. There's no doubt about it. Mount should be at a bottom-half Premier League team this season, at least. So I think they know that, and they can see the progress being made. And he's got a huge rapport with the fans as well, which is important. So it'll only be the other way if he does leave. I think it'll be him moving on.
I'm quite fond of Derby County. European Cup semi-finalists. Derbyshire is one of the great underrepresented English accents in the British media, I think. Yeah. Superb accent. But the thing with Leeds, I remember going to watch Swansea play Leeds at Elland Road in League One, 10 or 12, well, 2007 it must have been. And you can see how big a club it is when you get to Elland Road. There's just, it's a Premier League club in all but name. But also, I've loved what Marcelo Bielsa's brought to English football this season. He's, everybody knew that people like Pep Guardiola think he's the best coach on the planet. And it is a shame. But Aston Villa Derby is, it's going to be a great playoff final, I think. Well, let's look at West Brom versus Aston Villa. Villa won 4-3 on penalties. West Brom won 1-0 at the Hawthorns. Tammy Abraham with the winner after West Brom missed both of their first two. West Brom's first four penalties were taken by defenders, interestingly. How do you think Villa will get on in the playoffs?
Well, I mean, they're halfway there now. They've been really poor in the two games against West Brom. I think Villa fans would agree with me. Since Dean Smith's come into the club to replace Steve Bruce, they've been a real breath of fresh air. And the run they went on, the club record winning run towards the end of the season, was unbelievably impressive. They've got players in that squad who are destined for great things. John McGinn, who they brought in over the summer, has been an absolute revelation in midfield. Tyron Mings came in January. He's been fantastic. Axel Tuanzebe at the back, and then Jack Grealish is a player who's destined for just so much more than the Championship. It's just a bit of a farce that he's even in the league at the moment. And even though he's put in two pretty poor performances in the two playoff semi-finals, you've still got people who I think were watching him for the first time in a couple of years on social media afterwards, fairly influential people who were, I think, were taken aback by just how good he is now. And there was a reason why Tottenham were after him for 40 million last summer. So they've got all the assets to go up, and I think the job Dean Smith's done has been incredible, but there's got to be a concern over those two performances against West Brom, because they didn't really turn up and we're fairly lucky to get through.
Villa have beaten Derby easily in both games they've played against them this season. I think it was 3-0 at Pride Park, 4-0 at Villa Park.
But Leeds have beaten Derby 7-1 on aggregate over the course of the season.
Villa have also, they owe their fans one, because they really flopped in the playoff final last season. Fulham beat them 1-0, but it was a 1-0 hiding. Yeah. Villa just did not turn up.
Yeah.
And I remember being really surprised by just how bad they were. And it's going to be interesting. I wouldn't read too much into the fact that they've beaten Derby twice easily, but they do owe their fans one. They froze last season. They were abysmal in the playoff.
It always feels like teams who've had Wembley heartbreak the year before normally come back a bit stronger when they get there again, having been able to build on that experience.
I think I'm not misremembering this. I feel like Fulham gave Grealish some pretty rough treatment in that game. And I wonder, if he comes back harder from it, or indeed if Derby take a blueprint from it.
Well, it was interesting. I tweeted out the other day saying that he's accused of diving a lot, Grealish, and he's been fouled, I think it's now 340 times in the last three seasons, and is yet to be booked for diving. So, which suggests, he's just one of those players who, he will buy your foul, and he's very good at knowing how to use his ability to make you foul him.
But for a talented player like that in the Championship, which is quite an agricultural league, it'll be interesting to see him in the Premier League.
Well, anyone who saw the treatment that Steffi Hansen gave him over the two legs, where I think his instructions were just to kick Grealish, don't worry about the ball, just stop him. And I think that's fairly, that goes quite a lot during the season as well. So, but in the Premier League, I think when he's playing for a team who, whether it's Spurs or another one of the big boys, I think he'll kick on even
further.
Who
else has he been linked with? If he's been linked with Tottenham, is there anyone else who's interested?
United have been linked in the press as well. And then West Ham, Leicester. But I'd be surprised if he doesn't go to one of the top six. If Villa go up, I'm sure that they'll want to keep him, and I'm sure he'd probably want to have a go playing for Villa in the Premier League. But
well, West Brom are looking to interview Chris Houghton over the manager job, which has been vacant since they sacked Darren Moore. Where do you think that will happen?
I think it could do. I think he'd be a shrewd appointment. He seems to be a bit of a, you appoint him and you get promoted from the Championship. That seems to be the way it goes with Chris Houghton. I'm sure he'll have no shortage of suitors. There's rumours that Tony Pulis's days at Middlesbrough are coming to an end as well. I'm sure that Houghton would be high on their shortlist as well.
Well, Middlesbrough were top of the Championship in November. You know, at Christmas it looked like they were, well, they certainly looked like they were going to get a playoff place, and they've sort of fallen apart over the last couple of months.
Yeah.
The Swansea job would be available any day now.
Oh, God! Graham Potter's been linked with Brighton, which petrifies me. It would be the equivalent, I think, of when Roberto Martinez left Swansea. The problem we have is that it was an uncharacteristically shrewd appointment from our board, because, spent 7 years with Östersund and got a club that was averaging crowds of 500 into the Europa League. The problem with Graham Potter going is that he's worked miracles with a very, very young squad this season in the Championship. You know, a lot of kids from our under-23s. And I don't like the prospect, A, of shipping out players like Dan James or Matt Grimes, but also, because Dan James obviously has been linked with Man United, but more than anything, you'd then have a squad of young, disillusioned players, because they really look up to Graham Potter. So if he does go, then I really fear for us in the Championship next season. So at this stage, George, I'm asking you to tell me that it's not going to happen.
Have you seen the other name that's being linked, if it's not Potter, which doesn't seem to make much sense, is Phil Neville. Ahead of the Women's World Cup this summer, is being linked to. And I mean, my opinion on the whole Brighton Chris Houghton thing is that Tony Bloom is someone who is he's made his money from gambling. He's made his money from understanding football better than most people. And he would have seen the warning signs with Chris Hughton a mile off. So I think we can expect an appointment like Potter, someone who's maybe a little bit undervalued. So I don't understand where the Phil Neville link would come from and how that would work. But
that's interesting. I have heard that Phil Neville is finding the women's job a lot more difficult than he thought it would be. Amid rumours of an unhappy camp, but that could be absolute nonsense, but I have heard it from a reasonably reliable source. So it wouldn't surprise me if he gives up the England women's job after the World Cup, but I have no idea what his future plans are.
It would remind me a bit of when West Brom sat Darren Moore earlier in the season, where I was one of the people saying it's fair enough, but then when you replace him with the assistant after a 3-week search, it doesn't make much sense. It's similar with Brighton. The Hughton decision makes sense if they have an idea of who they want to get in. And if it's someone like Phil Neville, who may prove to be a very good coach in time, but there doesn't seem to be much logical thinking to make that switch.
I would be very surprised if Tony Bloom doesn't have a plan in place.
Agreed.
He's very shrewd.
Yeah.
The fans, the Brighton fans I know, are very disappointed that he's gone, though. The Brighton fans I know really support Chris Hughton and don't want him to be at the club.
We were talking about this on Monday. I think we were kind of in unanimous agreement that we're surprised, they're surprised he was sacked. I said on Monday, the only reason Brighton stayed up is because they weren't quite as bad as Cardiff.
Yeah.
And if that's your level of expectation and that's the bar you're hoping for to reach, you know, it's not.
And I see people seem to be forgetting as well that they spent £75 million last summer. It's not like he was given whether or not he was responsible for the signings is neither here nor there. He was given a squad that was spent that amount of money on and they expected results. And
their most expensive signings have not worked out.
No, not at all.
Well,
so to answer your question, I think that Potter is probably likely. All the sounds coming out of the club, out of the local media, despite initially, rebutting the first approach.
They refused Brighton permission to talk to him initially.
Just bump up the price a bit, I guess.
But yeah, his contract runs until 2021. But obviously, if he decides he wants to join Brighton, there's very little we can do about that. Oh, God, I want to die.
the thing is, for any Brighton fans listening, it's worth just pointing out who might be a bit concerned about Potter, given his lack of Premier League experience. He's such an exciting coach. I think, you know, you must be able to agree. The style of football played,
it's very progressive.
It is.
And he is a very modern coach. He's the opposite of, you know, someone like Tony Pulis in that doesn't he have an MA in emotional intelligence or something? And, you know, he's very good, I think, at dealing with young players and he's very good at improving players. So if you look at someone like Dan James, he has improved since January. His end product has improved. He's a better player now than he was at Christmas. And the frustrating thing with Graham Potter, or the frustrating thing with Swansea, I think we were actually so close. We were still in with a shout at the playoffs with two or three games to go. So if you do start selling your best players and potentially your manager, then where are we going to end up? And I actually think there are only a few missing pieces of the jigsaw for a really good tilt at promotion next season. But
there are similarities with your season and Norwich's season the year before.
Yes, that's a very good comparison.
It's a squad in transition with some young players coming through, having their first season, a really promising manager, and it just feels like it was just a season to consolidate your position.
And they got rid of some of their best players, didn't they, Norwich?
Mm. Pritchard and Madison.
Yeah. And then obviously it worked out for them. That's the end of part one. We'll be back to discuss some Italian football after this. Welcome back. Let's get stuck into more playoff chat. The Mike Dean second leg, as people are now referring to it. Forest Green Rovers 1, Tranmere Rovers 1, Tranmere 1-2-1 on aggregate. They'll be playing Newport County in the final. We've had a question in from Richard to Stan. Did anyone think Mike Dean wouldn't steal the show in Tranmere's playoff victory over Forest Green Rovers? I wanted to see him shirtless. That was the thing, because he had a puffer jacket on. But you know, if you're going to celebrate like that, go the whole hog, take your top off. I had no idea Mike Dean was a Tranmere Rovers fan.
It didn't come as a huge surprise to me. I didn't realise he was quite as an enthusiastic a Tranmere Rovers fan. He is from Wirral, isn't he?
Yeah, so I actually thought he was a Liverpool fan, but he's now replaced Half Man Half Biscuit as Tranmere Rovers' most famous celebrity supporter. And I'm an absolutely massive Half Man Half Biscuit fan, so it really pains me to say that. But that they'll be playing Newport County in the final, which is a week Saturday. Now, I personally, you know, they beat Mansfield on penalties at the weekend. I'm back in Newport in this because they are effectively a cup team, aren't they? In that, you know, they've had cup runs over the last 2 years. In 2017, Mark O'Brien scored the win against Notts County in, I think it was extra time. You know, I think under Mike Flynn, they had to win 7 of their last 12 games. They were 11 points adrift going into the last sort of 6 or 7 weeks of the season. I don't know. I just think that Mike Flynn, he is able to raise his team to perform out of their skin in these one-off matches. What do you think, George?
And over the course of the season. I mean, finishing 7th is a huge achievement for them. You mentioned the cup wins. I mean, they took Spurs to a replay last season. They got past both Leicester and Middlesbrough this season as well. So there's no denying his ability to get his team prepared and motivated for one-off games. But to finish 7th in League 2, given their budget, I think they've got quite comfortably the smallest budget in the league, if not the second smallest. So to do what he's done over 3 seasons is absolutely incredible. It reminds me of someone like Chris Wilder, who at every single job he goes to is just able to completely revolutionise the team. And that's what Flynn's done at Newport. And during this season's cup run, in between the Leicester and Borough games, they took 1 point in 5 games, which you'd have to put down probably to the congested fixture list or to players maybe not quite being focused on the league games. And if you put their points ratio into those games, they'd be up near the automatic places. And that is just unbelievable. So I'm all aboard the Mike Flynn bandwagon. He's done an unbelievable job.
Well, he was going to become an estate agent.
Yeah.
Because football wasn't working out for him. And his wife didn't want him to take the job at Newport County because they still live in the city. And she said, you know, if it goes sour, then,
all right,
you know, I don't need to get a boost in the street if it doesn't work out at Newport. And also, it looked an impossible job keeping Newport County up back in 2017. But also, I'm assuming as an ex-professional footballer, he's not a smoker. But that voice, that gravelly voice, fantastic. I don't know where that is, the sort of Sean Dyche sort of school of gravel. I love it. I can listen to him speak all day. Jonathan was...
I'm just wondering how that voice would have worked out for him if he had become an ex-age.
As a conservatory, my swell boys in living room, sea view... There's the velodrome over there.
Schools are all about around here, to be perfectly honest.
Because, yeah, he was. He's always been so honest with the press. It's very refreshing how honest Mike Flynn is with the press. So the idea of being an ultra-honest estate agent with a gravelly voice.
He would be the world's worst estate
either
agent.
Either the world's worst or the world's best, because you know that you can trust him implicitly. In the League One playoffs, Portsmouth are playing Sunderland tonight. Sunderland with a 1-0 win in the first leg. Barry, as this pod's resident Sunderland fan, how do you see it going?
I am not hugely optimistic. I don't think the 1-goal lead will be enough. Fratton Park is a real bear pit. Most hostile environments in English football, to be honest, and it's going to be rocking. There'll be 18,000 there, and I think if Sunderland don't score first tonight being Thursday, that they will go out. And I mean, either club would be worthy winners of promotion from League One, but. Yeah, I'm being pessimistic, but I hope I'm wrong.
I think the one key strength you've got tonight is a certain Chris Maguire, who's managed to already rile up the whole of Portsmouth with not only, I mean, I'm an Oxford fan, he's an ex-Oxford player, and he is a player who just thrives off annoying opposition players and fans consistently.
What's he done?
So he scored the winner at the Stadium of Light off the bench, and then proceeded at the full-time whistle to pick a fight with Burgess, who's Portsmouth's 6'4" centre-back, and he's about 5'6". And
I like the sound of this guy.
Squaring up to his chest. I mean, for some other stories, when we won, or when Oxford won their seventh game in a row at the County Ground against Swindon, he walked around the pitch with two fingers on one hand and five fingers on the other to all the Swindon fans, and then went over to Nathan Thompson, who now plays for Portsmouth, and made the crybaby face in his face. He is a person who... And if Pompey do decide, as it sounds like they're going to, that they are going to try and play against Maguire, then I give Sunderland a massive chance, because he will just absolutely revel in that atmosphere.
So he likes to act up to this kind of thing.
You could say that.
Would you suggest that there's a hidden darkness there?
I don't know if it's even hidden. I think it's just he's someone who anyone who's played against him or had him on their team will know that. And I think that he'll be the key tonight. He'll start tonight after what happened on Saturday.
I love those players. Mm. Football would be so much poorer without those people, I think.
Yeah.
Was it Charlie George who did a Mooney, sort of pulled his shorts and pants down when he scored a goal for Arsenal against, I can't remember which set of fans it was, but...
As a connoisseur of Welsh music, Ellis, you'll be aware of the Super Furry Animals single, The Man Don't Give a Fuck.
Oh, yeah, Robin
which,
Friday.
When it was eventually released, had Robin Friday.
Yes.
Flicking V's at a Luton player, I think.
Yeah, the lower league George Best used to knock sort of policemen's helmets off as part of his goal celebrations, and he would defecate in the opposition team's bath and all that kind of stuff. Really classic 70s. Sort of, he was a wayward footballer. He's a real cult hero at Reading and at Cardiff City as well. Well, Jonathan Wilson's tweeted, "Happy Gates and Gabbiadini Day," a reference to when Sunderland beat Newcastle in the second division playoffs 29 years ago today. And then you can actually see Jonathan's mentality change at sort of mid-tweet. "It's such a shame Sunderland are going to mess up the anniversary by getting gubbed at Portsmouth tonight. I might just watch my video of 1990 instead." Poor Jonathan. Tomorrow night, Charlton versus Doncaster. Charlton are bringing a 2-1 scoreline home from the first leg. George, speak to me.
Well, I think the interesting one here is if you spoke to football fans 10, 15 years ago and said, which Premier League footballer do you reckon is the least likely to be a successful League One manager? I think Lee Bowyer would have been pretty high on that list.
Yes, I would agree. Yeah.
And he has been unbelievably good. I mean, he has turned, given the off-field problems that they've got as well, he has turned that club around, where they lost manager Carl Robinson back last January on a terrible run of form, looking like they were going to fall out of the playoffs. He got them into the playoffs, fell just short. But this season, I mean, they've ended up finishing third. They weren't in the four-way race for automatic promotion, but yet still beat two of the teams that were. In Lyle Taylor, they've got a striker who they came in from AFC Wimbledon last season, is one of the class acts in the league. They lost Carlin Grant to Huddersfield in January. Didn't derail them at all. If anything, they kicked on. Lee Bowyer and his assistant, it must be said as well, Johnny Jackson, who's a Charlton club legend, have done one of the most impressive jobs in English football.
These are my own personal prejudices coming to play here, but Lee Bowyer, is he just very good at motivating players at that level, or does he show a tactical nous that someone like Frank Lampard maybe hasn't done over the last couple of months?
I think the tactical nous is there.
With Lee Bowyer.
Terrific player. I mean,
he was
people
a good
have
player. I just
mixed
remember,
opinions about
I just
him,
remember him but, fighting with, was it Jermaine Genus?
It was,
or was it Graeme Lascaux?
Kieran Dyer.
I just remember him fighting with Kieran Dyer. That is my memory of Lee Bowyer, and also, you know, court cases.
Well, he's good in a crisis as well, because he played the best football of his career for Leeds in the Champions League in the middle of a court case that could have, you know, finished his career if it had gone the wrong way.
Ruined his life, that court case.
So, you know, whatever your thoughts on him, you have to sort of salute his indefatigability, I suppose.
Yeah. You're the only person other than George Galloway I've ever heard use that word. So he referred to Saddam Hussein.
Did George Galloway say it about Lee Bowyer?
No, he said it about Saddam Hussein.
Shouldn't compare those two, I don't think.
No. But he has done a terrific job, because that club, behind the scenes, it's just the way it's run is comically inept.
Yeah, exactly. And to get the fans back on side as well. I mean, I've been to games at the Valley in the last couple of years where on Tuesday nights when just no one's there. So he came into a big club.
Big dormant fan base.
Exactly, and I'm sure they'll take, if they get there, if they can get past Doncaster. They got a 2-1 victory in the away leg, so you'd think, unless we see a repeat of last night, they probably will. They'll take a huge fan base there, and it'll be huge for the club to get back in the Championship as well. A big club.
Bowyer did, of course, as I'm sure you're aware, Ellis, between retiring and taking this job, earned his managerial stripes by running his own fishing lake somewhere in France.
I must admit, I didn't know that.
It's quite a career change.
Yeah.
So what, tranquility of sitting on the riverbank.
I can't believe I've had my opinions on Lee Bowyer changed. Turned on a sixpence over the last sort of 5 minutes. Extraordinary. So what, he was managing a fishing...
No, I think he's a very keen angler.
Right, so.
I think he owns a lake in France, and if you're into your angling or fishing, you can just go and pay to enjoy a nice fishing holiday with Lee as your guide. Lee's bait shop.
Charlton makes perfect sense now. It's great. Just get straight out down to France after the game.
Yeah.
Not too far at all.
Are you a fisherman, Polo?
I have gone fishing in the past, but I wouldn't describe myself as a fisherman, no.
Have we got any fishermen on this panel? George Barry?
I used to do it a bit when I was a kid, but found it very boring.
Yeah, that's what puts me off.
I'm quite scared of fish.
I think I wouldn't mind getting back into it. I see guys on Clapham Common just sitting, you know. I was about to say guys on Clapham Common sitting with their rods hanging out. That could be misconstrued.
A moment of madness.
Just sitting around the lake on Clapham, you know, the little tent, cans of lager on the go, just listening to their tunes and waiting for a bite.
Are there any fish on Clapham Common?
There are, yes.
I've always thought an allotment sounds quite nice for that reason. So 4:45, you've got the transistor radio as the scores are coming in, and you're, I don't know, putting carrots in a bucket or whatever happens in the shed of an allotment. But unfortunately, living in London, is about a 25-year waiting list for an allotment. It's easier said than done. How do you see your retirement going, Paolo?
I don't imagine myself in an allotment. Fishing, I could see. I quite like the sound of fishing. I think I'm slightly more of the mindset at the moment that, oh God, I'll never be able to retire, because people who retire have to have money with which to retire, which seems like a far-off prospect. But,
well, worryingly, all of our jobs will be replaced by artificial intelligence. So, you know, I mean, you're having a great debut on the pod, George, but in 5 years' time, I'll be talking to... Well, a robot will be interviewing another robot. So you'll be replaced by an algorithm. Sorry, it sounds like I'm having a go at you specifically, but this is going to happen to all of us. Okay. Sorry. So let's talk about the Coppa Italia. Lazio 2, Atalanta 0. Tell us about it, Paolo.
Yeah.
Before you lose your job to a robot.
It had the potential to be such a great one, this, because we're sort of so used to Juventus steamrolling everything the last few years, and they haven't this year. I mean, they obviously have in the league, but first time in four seasons, first time after four seasons, I suppose first time in five seasons, that Allegri hasn't taken Juventus to the cup final. That's because they got not just beaten, but absolutely spanked by Atalanta 3-0, who are this thrilling, ambitious team under Giampiero Gasperini this season. I mean, they have been ever since he got there, but they've sort of hit their peak so far under him, and drawing all sorts of comparisons with Ajax in Italy, and not just in the sort of surface level, oh, this is a team that plays attacking football and has some young players, therefore it's Ajax. I mean, they actually, stylistically, the way they play, the way they sort of approach the one-on-one situations all over the field and don't leave any defensive cover at times, the way they have... a forward in Zapata who clears out space and leaves space for sort of three attacking players to flood in behind him. There are some very sort of distinct stylistic similarities, and they've just a couple of weeks ago, at the beginning of the month, they went away to Lazio and beat them 3-1 in the league, and has put Atalanta in pole position for the Champions League. So you have this club that 14th biggest wage bill in Serie A. And when I say that, it's like an eighth the size of Juventus. It's really like a different order of magnitude to the richest clubs in Italy. They have got to themselves a position with 2 weeks left in the season where they are in fourth place, 3 points clear of Roma and Milan. And they're in the cup final, and it has this sort of potential to crescendo into something amazing. And it also has potential to fall apart because they're a club that's not used to being there. And the first part of it, the cup final, which is would have been their first win, well, second win ever of the cup, and the first since 1963, has fallen apart. They did in the end sort of look like they were nervous compared to Lazio. Lazio, this was their third cup final in 5 years. They played a very physical game, which Atalanta can play a very physical game, by the way, actually, but they did seem to get drawn into it in a negative way. They made it into something very sort of scrappy and you know, not especially attractive to watch, to be honest with you. It was great pageantry around the game, and the cup came down before kickoff with a woman tied to hundreds of balloons being sort of lowered down from the rafters, which was bonkers, to be honest. But but the game itself, yeah, it was the game which Lazio needed it to be, which was sort of ugly and messy, but they managed to exert a certain control over it in that mess, and play on the counter very fast, which they're very effective at. Atalanta should have had a penalty in the 25th minute. It was one of those things that in real time I didn't see at all, and I wouldn't blame a referee for not seeing it at all, because it's a shot from Duran that goes off Bastos' hand in the penalty area. But with VAR and the way it's been applied in Italy this season, it's 100% a penalty, and on the replays it's 100% clear. So I don't understand why there wasn't a VAR intervention on it. And if it had been given, Bastos would have had to go as well, because he's on a yellow card. So it should have been a huge swing point in the game in Atalanta's favour. They get this penalty, potentially score it, the opponent's down 10 men. None of that happens. And after that, Lazio sort of gradually managed to overwhelm them. And the goal in the end comes from a corner. Sergej Milinkovic-Savic, who's Lazio's star last season. You may remember he was being linked to Manchester United for like a €100 million transfer, but has been not great this season, has been a real sort of step back, and then was injured coming into this game, only comes off the bench like 4 minutes before, and one of his first touches of the game scores a header to make it 1-0, and then at the end, with Atalanta pouring forwards, Joaquin Correa scores a really, really nice second goal on the counter, and he was great on the counter all game. So Lazio take it. It's their seventh Coppa Italia ever, which is makes them joint third amongst all teams. So they've won this cup a lot. As I say, they've done it. They've been in the final favorite recently, and a sort of necessary salve to them for the season, because they were going for the Champions League and have really sort of fallen apart in recent months, and find themselves nowhere near that in the league anymore. And to win the cup means at least they get into Europe. But I think for a lot of neutrals, with love for all the Atalanta, with all the Lazio fans out there, for a lot of neutrals, I think there was a lot of hope that Atalanta were going to get to crown this season with a trophy, and they haven't been able to.
How have they done it? Because they were Serie B in as recently as 2011.
Yep.
Because they're not historically a big club in Italy, are they? Their ground only holds 21,000.
I mean, so Atalanta represent, they're from the city of Bergamo, which is a small city, it's 100, I'm maybe misspeaking the city, it's 120,000 people. It is a wealthy place. I mean, it's economically one of the more successful small towns in Italy, certainly, but it's not a big place at all. Antonio Percassi, the owner, has just sort of done a really smart job I suppose he doesn't do it directly, but employing the directors and encouraging a policy which we've seen from other Italian clubs have done well in sort of not distant times, like Udinese. High turnover of players, bringing in good value propositions, letting them move on. And the real key to that, always, to being a team that is going to keep moving players in and out, is to have a very good manager. They also have an exceptional youth academy, Atalanta. They've had that for years and years, though. That goes back a long time. But it's having a manager who can do it. And over the last 3 years, Gasperini, who's, for me, absolutely one of the best managers in Italy at the moment, and I think he has been for a while, but had his whole reputation tarnished by a very brief stint he got at Inter, where it went calamitously wrong. He lasted, I can't remember exactly, like 4 or 5 games before he got the sack, because everyone just decided before he even got started that his sort of attempt to play with the back three at the time was considered a small club thing. You can't do that at Inter. He had Wesley Schneider, who he told the then owner Moratti to sell him because, look, he doesn't fit the way I want to play, and they didn't sell him. And then Gasperini, who at the time was very wedded to sort of a three-man attack, had this number 10, didn't know what to do with him. So it was a mess all around that particular season, but it really dented Gasperini's reputation for a long time. But actually at Genoa before, and then he went back to Genoa and did it again, and now at Atalanta, he's been really consistent in sort of getting teams to produce above what they should. And he's the key to this Atalanta team for me. He's dealt with sort of every year he's been there, guys who have gone on to bigger clubs, from Frank Kessié going to Milan, Andrea Conti going to Milan, Zappa Costa going to Juventus. All these guys sort of came and went. And the upshot has been like no damage to his team. Caldara last season, who goes to Juventus and then on to Milan, was supposed to be, you know, the best young centre-back in Italy and might yet be, but he's been injured. But without him, Atalanta haven't missed a beat. And yeah, he's done really extraordinary work there. It was actually really sort of gut-wrenching after the final, because he got through the whole game and was disappointed, as you imagine, but came off and seemed to sort of be prepared to sort of take this quite sort of, well, that's football kind of approach to it. And then someone showed him the penalty incident and he hadn't seen a replay of it for the whole game. And he, you know, you could see it. It broke him. He was like, well, that's a penalty. And he couldn't let go of it after that. He's like, that, you know, all season we've been giving this. This is, you know, completely unprecedented. Like, how has this happened? And yeah, like, I think he was really sort of... And now there's this sort of very delicate situation for him, because, as I say, they're 3 points clear and on course for the Champions League, which would be extraordinary, arguably even more extraordinary than the million cup competition, which, of course, you know, knockout competition, things can happen. And they have to pick themselves up off the floor from this, and it's the next game is Juventus away from home. So yeah, it's a very delicate point now in the season. But
I'm very fond of gone. Atalanta, because they lost to Merthyr in the 87-88 European Cup Winners' Cup. Merthyr Town, they lost 2-1 at Pennydown Park and then beat them 2-0 in the return fixture. So they got to the semi-final of the European Cup Winners' Cup season.
There's a fun thing about Atalanta as well, because it's not such a big city, they're able to do this. Every newborn kid in Bergamo gets sent an Atalanta shirt. Like, that's, you know, it is like, it's a real, like, one.
Oh, wow.
It's like a real one club place. Yeah.
That's absolutely fantastic.
The other thing from Italy, in case you missed it, is Daniele De Rossi, of course, is going to have his final game at Roma a week from now. They sort of announced that very low key this week, and it's gone down tremendously badly with the fan base. I don't know
why so badly.
Well, I mean, this is what's interesting about it, really, because realistically, he is 36 years old now. He is declining as a player. His ability to contribute has diminished. The thing which is very often very important in Italy. I suppose this would be true any club in the world for a player who's sort of as integral as De Rossi. I mean, you think he's a Roman kid who spent his entire career as Capitan Futuro, future captain behind Totti. Totti finally goes and he's got like 5 minutes as captain, and now he's on his way out as well. But form is very important in Italy. I mean, people talk a lot about la bella figura, which is, you know, this idea of keeping up appearances. And I think that you do... I think sometimes lose this with foreign owners. Sometimes they don't necessarily recognize how important it is to do things just the right way. Even if you're going to say goodbye to De Rossi, which is going to be something that's going to be contested, by doing things the right way. And De Rossi, since sort of finding out that they weren't going to renew his contract, because he's not retiring, you know, he says he still wants to play, found out they weren't going to renew his contract through one of the club's directors, the CEO, and subsequent to having his final press conference, an audio message, like a voicemail that he sent to a friend of his, has come out, where basically the thing he seems to be most peeved about is that he feels like James Pilotta, the owner, didn't call him, like neither did Baldini, who's his number one sort of assistant. Like, why didn't I get a call from these guys? Why am I not getting, you know, the respect I deserve as someone who's been all the way through this? And I think fans are really sort of upset about that, because it's like, well, this is a, you know, a club icon, and these American Johnny Come Latelys have come and treated him disrespectfully. And I'm certain that wouldn't have been intended. You know, Jim Pilotta is someone who I believe has tried to do things the right way at Roma, but it certainly seems to have really sort of flamed this one up, because, you know, in this voicemail message, De Rossi says, oh, I was suggesting that I could do a contract where I just get paid like 100 grand per match and there's no like commitment beyond that. And then once I'd said that, then I finally got a call from Pilotta and suddenly he was interested. And then I thought that was so disrespectful that, you know, this was the only time he was going to talk to me. And, you know, it's a it's a lot about the way things have been done as much as it is about the fact that he's going. But also the fact that he's going, and that Rome has, you know, all my fans having just said goodbye to Totti and now saying goodbye to De Rossi as well, who for more than a generation of fans, for several generations of fans, they've had these sort of two homegrown club icons to hold on to and to feel represented by. It is the end of an era as well, which is something so very hard to I don't know, process as a fan.
Disappointingly, Serie A have opted not to sanction Cagliari for the racist abuse of Juventus striker Moise Keane. They say in a statement, it emerged the chance in question, although certainly reprehensible, had an objectively limited relevance to race, which is an extraordinary statement. I mean, for a, you know, for a body like that, it's extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, it's dismal and... yeah, I don't even know what to say about some of these things anymore, because I mean I know that when the incident first happened I sort of came on here and you know, spoke my mind on it, and I was hugely disappointed with the response there, and I suppose then I was more focused on the response from his teammates, which was well, from certain teammates in particular, was just pathetic, and I find this very disappointing as well. I mean, look again, Coppa Italia final, they had this artwork got released, a piece of art that's been commissioned about to sort of raise the point of you know, racist abuse and how awful it is, and it's, you know, a piece of art which, fine, I'm sure for some people might look at it and see something in it that's very powerful or not, but the point is, why are we talking about a piece of flipping artwork rather than actually trying to do something to fix the problems in the game? And you know, this is actually, sorry, because I know some people don't give a stuff about Italian football, so apologies for bringing up another thing, but I should have said this earlier when we were talking about the Coppa Italia final. Outside the Coppa Italia final, 200 or so Lazio fans who went at police, set fire to a police car, from the reports. It sounds like it wasn't even Atalanta fans, like them fighting against Lazio fans. It was just Lazio fans going for the police because they wanted to. And I think whilst they're two separate issues on a certain level, racism and fan violence, there is a common thread of a particular element of ultra culture that Italian football has persistently refused to deal with. Yeah,
and also Lazio's fans, they have a poor reputation.
Yeah,
amongst Italian clubs, you know, whenever you know, British clubs have gone over to Rome, and there's been trouble most times. And I don't know, were you with Serie A not sanctioning Cagliari for the racist abuse? Were you expecting anything better from them?
No, honestly, no. I mean, you know, was I expecting anything? I think I thought they'd be fined. Yeah, I thought it'd be something, but I didn't think it would be anything that made me think that, oh, we're really trying to address this and change the culture.
A fairly long rap sheet in this department, do they, Cagliari?
Cagliari, yes. I mean, there's been very high-profile instances before in their stadium. I suppose for sake of completeness, I'll say what I said at the time, which is that there were a lot of people, including some journalists who I have a lot of respect for inside that stadium, who said, look, I personally didn't hear anything. So it wasn't necessarily a situation where the whole stadium is making... It wasn't a situation where the whole stadium is making monkey chants. But nevertheless, the sort of fact that a clear number of people did hear them, to me, is enough that this should be taken a lot more serious than a lot more seriously than it has been.
Okay, well, we'll end part two there. We'll be back for part three, where we'll be discussing three cup finals. Welcome back to part three at Wembley this weekend, three cup finals. First up on Saturday, the FA Cup final between Watford and Man City. Man City going for an unprecedented domestic treble. My opinion, I don't think enough people are saying this, it's actually quite weird how good Man City are. It's weird. They're too good. It's so horrible. Not because I've got any particular problem with Man City. It's just, even the, you know, the great domestic teams of the past, you know, Man United under Ferguson, Liverpool in the 70s and 80s, even Forest under Clough, the Arsenal Invincibles, there was always a chink. There was always a chink in the armour, but, oh, God, it's not.
Well, isn't the chink in City's armour what happened
against the Champions League?
Well, I mean, it's Tottenham. Yeah, it's that over 38 games, even if you're as ridiculous as Liverpool were this season, you're still not going to catch them. But on a single game, you can still... And, you know, it's not like this is like the only time we've ever seen. Like, every now and then in these sort of big games, and the Champions League has been the greatest ground, you know, the greatest sort of stage for it, like Pep Guardiola just sort of does something a bit odd. Like in the first leg against Tottenham, he just sort of does a team selection that you think, what?
Yeah.
What was that about? I suppose that's the closest we got to a chink in the armour.
Pep overthinking things.
Yeah. It's true. The chink in the armour is they're so good that their manager starts to get...
Pep having a funny 5 minutes, yeah. Which is how my primary school teacher used to refer to it.
What I find frustrating is that because they're so good, it means that the teams they play against consistently just sit unbelievably deep.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which means that as like a viewing spectacle, it's not as exciting as it should be because it's just attack versus defence.
And you end up with those amazing statistics where they get 87% possession. So it's kind of football, but not really football.
But you'd think that Watford, A, because Javi Gracia sets them up in a way where they do press a bit higher, and because it's a one-off cup game, you'd hope they'd come out the blocks a bit rather than just play a couple of banks of four. But
well, Jose Holobas has got some good news this week. His red card has been rescinded, meaning that he's available to play in the final. It should have been a week of celebration for Man City, but they found themselves on the back foot in the press. Number one, for the video which came out, them singing a derogatory song about Liverpool and their fans getting attacked in Kiev. Which, what did you make of that, Barry?
I thought it was a little tasteless. I don't think it's that big a deal, but Man City made the situation worse by releasing this bizarre statement.
Yeah.
In which they stressed emphatically that it was no reference to Hillsborough and no reference to Sean Cox, the Irish Liverpool fan who was suffered a life-changing injury on his way to a game last year. You know, so it was like, no, it wasn't that violence we were referring to. It was different violence. So, you know, I imagine a lot of the players didn't even know what they were singing.
Yeah.
And I think City could have just said, look, we're sorry.
Yeah.
It's inappropriate and we're sorry. And that would have been an end to it. But instead, they went on the defensive, which was kind of weird. But again, a lot of the people who are demanding an apology are also the very people who wouldn't accept one if they got one, you know, because the world is a very unforgiving place these days.
It just seems to be so simple. If you're a Man City player and you've just won the Premier League, sing an Oasis song. Noel Gallagher's probably there. You know, just sing Wonderwall, and then no one's getting upset by that. Well, the other thing that's happened to Man City this week is there was a New York Times article by friend of the pod, Tariq Panja, which claimed that the investigation into accusations that City misled UEFA over how the club was keeping within the boundaries of the financial fair play rules is set to recommend that City are banned from UEFA competitions for at least a season. Now, Barry, you know a little bit about this. So the allegations are that they've been inflating sponsorship deals, you know, so that it looks like they're abiding by the financial fair play rules.
Yeah, that's right. Football League's allegations suggest that the Man City owners are pouring their own cash in and then putting it through the books as sponsorship from Etihad Airlines, for example. City never actually denied these allegations. Anytime they're made, they say it's an attempt to discredit the reputation of the club. They say that they point out that the information has come from documents that were hacked. They obfuscate about it, never actually deny the allegations outright. They kind of came close to doing that this week by saying they were false and that they had sent proof to UEFA. Now, the thing, financial fair play, City have agreed to abide by these rules. Whatever your thoughts on financial fair play, City fans will always argue that it was instigated as a, you know, a glass ceiling to prevent clubs like City from buying their way to the top and breaking the hegemony at the top of European football's clubs, richest clubs. And they may well have a point. That probably is why it was introduced. But the fact of the matter is City have agreed to abide by these rules, and if they're found to have broken them, they deserve to be punished. I personally can't see UEFA throwing them out of the Champions League for a season because they're too big a name. And if UEFA did so, they'd, you know, there'd be a legal shitstorm that City would go to court over it, and it would take a very...
Well, they'd
just be expensive and take a long time.
They'd probably have to defer it because, obviously, qualification for the Champions League starts in June. So it'd be very difficult to do it between now and then.
Yeah, they could defer it for a season. I think they'll just get a fine, which if you know, UEFA take it further, they'll get a fine which won't hurt them. And they would in effect have said, you know, well, clubs don't need to abide by financial play. It would be a huge victory over UEFA. So it will be interesting to see what happens.
It's just with the financial fair play rules, if they are consistently flouted by the biggest clubs, then you have to question what the point of them is in the first place.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
I think this is the point we've reached, isn't it? Like, this case already feels like, and it's very much at the beginning. We know that City are going to challenge it if there is any sort of punishment that comes their way. I find it hard to imagine a scenario in which you find no evidence that's problematic here, because otherwise, why would they have referred it? But then, if they do find something that's problematic and they don't try to wield some sort of serious punishment here, then the system is toothless, and at that point it falls apart. So City are taking a very hard, you know, aggressive stance, saying we're going to challenge this, and I think UEFA probably know that's coming, but it does feel like it's got the potential to be the landmark case for FFP, because if it doesn't, if UEFA can't win this, if UEFA have a ruling on this and they can't deliver it, then why should any other club respect it?
Well, PSG won their appeal to dismiss UEFA's investigation into the club's financial affairs. The Court of Arbitration ruled the decision to close the initial case was final and binding. You wonder what the point of financial fair play is.
I think the point when it was first introduced was to prevent clubs spending beyond their means and therefore not achieving the success they wanted, and then having financial difficulties. You look at a case like Leeds with FFP, and that wouldn't have happened. But clubs who have the cash and have the affluence will always find loopholes to get around it. So this is going to forever be an ongoing issue where clubs like PSG and Man City have to abide by it. But it wasn't introduced to curtail them. It was introduced for the, you know, to try and help the prosperity of clubs in general. So this is going to be an ongoing issue. If this one, this will be the latest case, and will carry on being a string of them amongst the likes of PSG and Man City, who'll continue to look for ways to get around it.
You say it wasn't introduced to curtail them, but it does curtail them.
It does, of course. Yeah. I mean, that's a byproduct of it.
Their fans will legitimately argue that that's unfair.
Yeah, I mean, but I want to say it as well. Like, what I just said about it's a landmark history, it doesn't mean that I necessarily think it's a good implemented system. It's definitely a system that protects the existing rich. That's what it does. Like,
for a club like Man City, for them to be hurt by a fine, that fine would have to be so massive.
Just take a player off them. There you go.
Yeah, but
a transfer ban is you know, the halfway punishment that is not an exclusion from the Champions League that would actually affect City. That's something.
Would you though?
Well,
Chelsea look like it's going to be the best thing that's happened to them in terms of rebuilding and being able to improve from a pretty low point. I mean, City obviously aren't at a very low point to have to improve from, but I don't hurt too much with it.
I like the idea of trying to work out how many digits this fine would have to be, and what you do with the money, whether it just sat in UEFA's coffers, because it would have to be millions. I like the idea.
Like over hundreds of millions.
Yeah.
It would. You know, you could fine Man City £100 million. It wouldn't matter. It's two full backs.
Three Claudio Bravos, isn't it? That's it.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm now... City released a statement on Tuesday to say that the accusations of financial irregularities are entirely false, and comprehensive proof of this fact has been provided to the CFCBIC. Then this morning, after UEFA announced that they are to refer the case to their disciplinary board, they said that Manchester City Football Club is disappointed but regrettably not surprised by the sudden announcement of the referral to be made by the CFCBIC chief investigator, Yves Letombe. The leaks to media over the last week are indicative of the process that has been overseen by Mr. Letombe. Manchester City is entirely confident of a positive outcome when the matter is considered by an independent judicial body. The accusations of financial irregularities remain entirely false, and the CFCBIC referral ignores a comprehensive body of irrefutable evidence provided by Manchester City FC to the Chamber. The decision contains mistakes, misinterpretations and confusions fundamentally born out of a basic lack of due process, and there remain significant unresolved matters raised by Manchester City FC as part of what the club has found to be a wholly unsatisfactory, curtailed and hostile process.
Oof. For an outfit that had very little to say about the matter when questioned on it relentlessly in, you know, over the last year or so, they can't get statements out quickly enough at the moment. So
yeah.
I think Mr. Tariq, friend of the pod, Panja, has seriously rattled their cage.
It's, you know, my totally tangential aside, this, I just love the fact that the guy who's the chairman and chief investigator of UEFA's financial control body, Yves Letombe, he used to be the Prime Minister of Belgium. What a career. What a career. You've been Belgian Prime Minister and now you're leading, I don't know, financial investigations against football clubs.
Yeah, well, Tariq Panja tweeted this morning, the point City appear to be focusing on, beyond the complaints about the media, is about this being about financial irregularities, whereas it seems the most pertinent issue is to do with whether the club misled officials, which is an interesting strategy. Well, in happy news, on Sunday, it's non-league finals day. Kicking off with an FA Vars final, which will be played between Chertsey Town, champions of the Combined Counties Premier Division, and Cray Valley Paper Mills FC, themselves Southern Counties East League Premier Division champions. Kevin Isby is turning up for Cray Valley and has been for the last two seasons. He's 40 now. Both Chertsey and Cray Valley are making their first FA Vars final appearances. And then the FA Trophy kicks off later in the afternoon with Fylde playing Leighton Orient. Fylde will be playing at Wembley for the second time in 9 days. They'll be looking to get over their 3-0 playoff defeat to Salford City. Leighton Orient, of course, went up automatically. Are we fans of the FA Trophy? Of the FA Vars?
Having briefly supported a team who played in what was then the conference, no, it wasn't a particularly big priority, and it's almost quite, I mean, similar to the Chequered trade now, it's just quite annoying to have to play in it until you get to the final, I think.
Yeah, it's a bit like the LDV. Not even called that anymore,
the Chequered trade. Barry will say, I think with Sunderland initially, as the season goes on, you can't really be bothered, and then suddenly you're at Wembley and it's a great day out.
When Swansea got to the LDV Vans Trophy final, you know, no one cared until the final,
and then
suddenly there's 35,000 fans at the Millennium Stadium, and it was great. But it's just one of those slightly odd competitions. Antoine Griezmann is leaving Atletico Madrid. He announced it with a video. It's very modern.
Well, he announced last summer that he was staying there with a video, so he just loves making
videos. Yeah.
There's a good quote where they said that Atletico Madrid have asked Antoine Griezmann to stop making documentaries, which I thought was...
Spanish radio station Cadena Ser reporting that Griezmann was preparing another documentary to announce that he was leaving Atletico Madrid. The club found out and told him to stop making documentaries and publish the video. Johnny Sharp was on Twitter saying he looks like a YouTuber being forced to apologise for a prank that resulted in a forest fire.
God.
And one of my favourite people of all time, Chris Coleman, has been sacked by Hebei China Fortune after 11 months in charge. He leaves Hebei one place off the bottom with just the one win in their first 9 games this season. I thought this was very sweet. During their 3-2 defeat to mid-table Henan Jiani on Saturday, fans held up a banner which said, "Hello, Mr. Coleman, please go home. You're fired." And then there was some Chinese script which translated to, "Coleman, your mum wants you home for dinner."
I was looking at that and thinking about the hostility of the Wenger out protests and thinking, would a change of tone have achieved things differently?
Exactly, or, you know, Galatasaray's welcome to hell. Go home for your dinner is a much, much sweeter way. I don't know if that's the way football's
It feels like a shame that Netflix, instead of carrying on following Sunderland, it would have been better if they'd just followed Chris Coleman to that job, given what's happened.
I mean, what a fall from grace.
I know.
You know, taking Wales, smallest country to reach the semi-finals of a major international tournament less than 3 years ago. Sunderland, and now this, being told to go home for his dinner because his mum's waiting for him by some Chinese fans, written on a banner in a language he doesn't even understand.
Wait, what next for him, do you think?
I don't know.
What would you... Would there be any chance he'd rock up at Swansea?
Well...
And would you be happy with his appointment if he did?
He has said several times in the past that because his entire family still live in the town hill area of Swansea, that he doesn't fancy it because... If it goes wrong, he doesn't want his family to get abuse because it's too high pressure for him, bearing in mind that his family still live in the city. He would be, I suspect, a very unpopular choice amongst our fan base. You know, a lot of club football fans don't care that much about international football. I love international football and I will always thank him for that summer. However, it's such a different job, international football, to international management in comparison with club management. I think that the undoubted strengths he has, which is motivation, building team spirit, getting excellent performances out of quite average players, which he was very good at. Also,
not Sunderland, he was.
No, but you can't underestimate how much the Welsh squad loved him. So as soon as we failed to qualify for Russia 2018 by losing to Ireland in Cardiff, they all, a delegation went in immediately and begged him to stay. And Gareth Bale, who was injured in that game, watching from the stands, that was the first thing he did, was he went in and said to Chris Coleman, please don't go. He decided to leave and went to Sunderland. Obviously now Wales managed by Ryan Giggs. He definitely had something. I think you can't dispute these slightly strange circumstances, or these strange circumstances that he took over, because obviously, Gary Speed taking his own life, and then it was Gary's team. You know, they were very young players that had come through the ranks under Toshack, and then with Gary, and things really started to look up under Gary Speed. And I think he dealt with the grieving process very intelligently and very, I think he obviously showed some real emotional intelligence coping with young players who'd lost their mentor. So, I don't doubt that he has many qualities. I am unconvinced by him as a club manager. So I don't know. I'm not sure he'd fancy the job at the Liberty. That said...
Can he afford to be picky?
I think he's running out of options.
But given his choices previously, going to Spain, going to China, you'd guess it'd probably be another job somewhere around the world.
He managed in Greece as well.
And Greece, yeah.
I feel like there's a fascinating autobiography in Chris Coleman at some point.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like, he almost lost his
leg in that car accident. He had that terrible car crash. And when the paramedics arrived on the scene, they thought they were going to have to amputate there and then. Bloody. Ended his career. He's been through an awful lot. He was also one of Gary Speed's roommates. Like, they were old friends because they played for Wales together at youth level and then in the first team. He does have an interesting autobiography in him, and he's now probably got time to write it.
Yeah.
But, I'm not sure. Anyway, we've had a question in from Ram S. The pod's favourite person, Jose Mourinho, is doing victory laps, hoping that people realise his second place finish with this clusterfuck of a management and players is truly an achievement. Does he have a point? Please tell me he doesn't. This is in reference to Jose telling L'Equipe that nice guy managers become puppets, in reference to the managers replaced at Manchester United, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Where do you stand on that, Barry? Guy managers become puppets?
I don't agree. I don't think... I mean, it depends on your definition of nice, I suppose. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is a nice bloke, but I'm under no illusions. There's a ruthless streak in there. So I think Jose is basically talking people who take over from me. When he's referring to nice guy, because he generally leaves clubs under a cloud. It's been unpleasant, it's been toxic, and whoever follows him is just by default going to be a nice guy because they're nicer than him.
Yeah. It's a very low bar, isn't it, of niceness. And a final question. This is for Paolo, although anyone else, if they fancy, can get involved. Can Paolo recommend somewhere in Italy for a city break that has a decent stadium I can have a tour / poke around of? I'm not thinking mainstream, so no Milan, Turin, Rome.
My immediate instinct, and I haven't done the tour of their stadium. I'm pretty certain they do offer one. But my immediate instinct is Bologna, because if you're going for a city break, in my opinion, you get the best food in Italy in Bologna. That's partly biased because it's close to my family's
I'm going in June.
Oh, I'll give you a chat. It's certainly one of the best places to get pasta in Italy. The stadium, the Dell'Ara, I think is a charming stadium. It's got the tower on one side. It's obviously, like a lot of Italian stadiums, not a modern behemoth, but it's got character and it's dedicated to, officially sort of named after Arpad Weiss, who was a former manager there, who was briefly tremendously successful and was subsequently, because he was Jewish, was I believe killed by the Nazis in a concentration camp. So it's got some history and some story behind it as well. So that's a great place to go for a mini break, in my opinion.
There you go, Matt. Just quickly, you big fan of pasta, Paolo?
As stereotyped as it is, yes, I eat a good amount of pasta.
Can I recommend Strada? It's super pasta at high street prices, very, very reasonable. Cool. Okay. Well, thank you, Barry. Thank you, George. Thank you, Paolo. Max is back on Monday. Thank you very much for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.